has reverently studied all world religions, the Jain scriptures, the biblical New Testament, and the sociological writings of Tolstoy are the three main sources of Gandhi's non-violence convictions. He has stated his credo thus: I believe the Bible, the Quran, and the Zend Avesta to be as divinely inspired as the Vedas. I believe in the institution of gurus, but in this age millions must go without a guru, because it is a rare thing to find a combination of perfect purity and perfect learning. But one need not despair of ever knowing the truth of one's religion, because the fundamentals of Hinduism, as of every great religion, are unchangeable and easily understood. I believe, like every Hindu, in God and his oneness, in rebirth and salvation. I can no more describe my feelings for Hinduism than for my own wife. She moves me as no other woman in the world can. Not that she has no faults. I dare say she has many more than I see myself. But the feeling of an indissoluble bond is there. Even so, I feel for and about Hinduism, with all its faults and limitations. Nothing delights me so much as the music of the Gita, or the Ramayana, by Tulsidas. When I fancied I was taking my last breath, the Gita was my solace. Hinduism is not an exclusive religion. In it, there is room for the worship of all the prophets of the world. Hinduism is not a missionary religion in the ordinary sense of the term. It has no doubt absorbed many tribes in its fold, but this absorption has been of an evolutionary, imperceptible character. Hinduism tells each man to worship God according to his own faith or dharma, and so lives at peace with all religions. Of Christ, Gandhi has written, I am sure that if he were living here now among men, he would bless the lives of many who perhaps have never even heard his name, just as it is written, Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, but he that doeth the will of my Father. In the lesson of his own life, Jesus gave humanity the magnificent purpose and the single objective toward which we all ought to aspire. I believe that he belongs not solely to Christianity, but to the entire world, to all lands and races. On my last evening at Wada, I addressed the meeting which had been called by Mr. Desai in Town Hall. The room was thronged to the window sills with about 400 persons assembled to hear the talk on yoga. I first spoke in Hindi, then in English. Our little group returned to the ashram in time for a good night glimpse of the Mahatma, deep in peace and correspondence. Night was still lingering when I rose at 5 a.m. Village life was already stirring. First a bullock cart by the ashram gates, then a peasant with his huge burden balanced precariously on his head. After breakfast, our trio sought out Gandhi for farewell pranams. The saint rises at 4 o'clock for his morning prayer. Mahatmaji, goodbye. I knelt to touch his feet. India is safe in your keeping. Years have rolled by since the Vada idyll. The earth, oceans and skies have darkened with a world at war. Alone among great leaders, Gandhi has offered a practical, non-violent alternative to armed might. To redress grievances and remove injustices, the Mahatma has employed non-violent means, which again and again have proved their effectiveness. He states his doctrine in these words: I have found that life persists in the midst of destruction. Therefore, there must be a higher law than that of destruction. Only under that law would well-ordered society be intelligible and life worth living. If that is the law of life, we must work it out in daily existence. Wherever there are wars, wherever we are confronted with an opponent, conquer by love. I have found that the certain law of love has answered in my own life, as the law of destruction has never done. In India, we have had an ocular demonstration of the operation of this law on the widest scale possible. I don't claim that non-violence has penetrated the 360 million people in India, but I do claim it has penetrated deeper than any other doctrine in an incredibly short time. It takes a fairly strenuous course of training to attain a mental state of non-violence. It is a disciplined life, like the life of a soldier. The perfect state is reached only when the mind, body and speech are in proper coordination. Every problem would lend itself to solution if we determined to make the law of truth and non-violence the law of life. The grim march of world political events points inexorably to the truth that without spiritual vision, the people perish. Science, if not religion, has awakened in humanity a dim sense of the insecurity and even insubstantiality of all material things. Where indeed may man go now, if not to his source and origin, the spirit within him? Consulting history, one may reasonably state that man's problems have not been solved by the use of brute force. World War I produced an earth-chilling snowball of dread karma that swelled into World War II. Only the warmth of brotherhood can melt the present colossal snowball of sanguinary karma that may otherwise grow into World War III. Unholy 20th Century Trinity. Use of jungle logic instead of human reason in settling disputes will restore the earth to a jungle. If not brothers in life, then brothers in violent death. It was not for such ignominy that God lovingly permitted man to discover the release of atomic energies. War and crime never pay. The billions of dollars that went up in the smoke of explosive nothingness would have been sufficient to have made a new world, one almost free from disease and completely free from poverty. Not an earth of fear, chaos, famine, pestilence, the dance macabre, but one broad land of peace, prosperity, and widening knowledge. The non-violent voice of Gandhi appeals to man's highest conscience. Let nations ally themselves no longer with death but with life, not with destruction but with construction, not with hate but with the creative miracles of love. One should forgive under any injury, says the Mahabharata. It hath been said that the continuation of the species is due to man's being forgiving. Forgiveness is holiness. By forgiveness, the universe is held together. Forgiveness is the might of the mighty. Forgiveness is sacrifice. Forgiveness is quiet of mind. Forgiveness and gentleness are the qualities of the self-possessed. They represent eternal virtue. Non-violence is the natural outgrowth of the law of forgiveness and love. If loss of life becomes necessary in a righteous battle, Gandhi proclaims, one should be prepared, like Jesus, to shed his own, not others, blood. Eventually, there will be less blood spilt in the world. Epics shall someday be written on the Indian Satyagrahis, who withstood hate with love, violence with non-violence, who allowed themselves to be mercilessly slaughtered rather than bear arms. The result, on certain historic occasions, was that opponents threw down their guns and fled, shamed, shaken to their depths by the sight of men who valued the lives of others above their own. I would wait, if need be, for ages, Gandhi says, rather than seek the freedom of my country through bloody means. The Bible warns us, all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. The Mahatma has written, I call myself a nationalist, but my nationalism is as broad as the universe. It includes in its sweep all the nations of the earth. My nationalism includes the well-being of the whole world. I do not want my India to rise on the ashes of other nations. I do not want India to exploit a single human being. I want India to be strong in order that she can infect the other nations also with her strength. Not so with a single nation in Europe today, they do not give strength to the others. President Wilson mentioned his beautiful 14 points, but said, "After all, if this endeavor of ours to arrive at peace fails, we have our armaments to fall back upon." I want to reverse that position, and I say, our armaments have failed already. Let us now be in search of something new. Let us try the force of love and God, which is truth. When we've got that, we shall want nothing else. By the Mahatma's training of thousands of true satyagrahis, those who have taken the 11 rigorous vows mentioned in the first part of this chapter, who in turn spread the message, by patiently educating the Indian masses to understand the spiritual and eventually material benefits of non-violence, by arming his people with non-violent weapons, non-cooperation with injustice, the willingness to endure indignities, prison, death itself rather than resort to arms, by enlisting world sympathy through countless examples of heroic martyrdom among satyagrahis, Gandhi has dramatically portrayed the practical nature of non-violence, its solemn power to settle disputes without war. Gandhi has already won through non-violent means a greater number of political concessions for his land than any other leader of a country has ever won except through bullets. Non-violent methods for eradication of all wrongs and evils have been strikingly applied not only in the political arena but in the delicate and complicated field of Indian social reform. Gandhi and his followers have removed many long-standing feuds between Hindus and Mohammedans. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims look to the Mahatma as their leader. The untouchables have found in him their fearless and triumphant champion. "If there be a rebirth in store for me," Gandhi wrote, "I wish to be born a pariah in the midst of pariahs, because thereby I will be able to render them more effective service." The Mahatma is indeed a great soul, but it was illiterate millions who had the discernment to bestow the title. This gentle prophet is honored in his own land. The lowly peasant has been able to rise to Gandhi's high challenge. The Mahatma wholeheartedly believes in the inherent nobility of man. The inevitable failures have never disillusioned him. "Even if the opponent plays him false 20 times, he writes, "the satyagrahi is ready to trust him the 21st time, for an implicit trust in human nature is the very essence of the creed." Mahatmaji, you are an exceptional man. You must not expect the world to act as you do. A critic once made this observation. It is curious how we delude ourselves, fancying that the body can be improved, but that it is impossible to evoke the hidden powers of the soul, Gandhi replied. I am engaged in trying to show that if I have any of those powers, I am as frail a mortal as any of us, and that I never had anything extraordinary about me, nor have I now. I am a simple individual, liable to err like any other fellow mortal. I own, however, that I have enough humility to confess my errors and to retrace my steps. I own that I have an immovable faith in God and His goodness, and an unconsumable passion for truth and love. But is that not what every person has latent in him? He added, if we may make new discoveries and inventions in the phenomenal world, must we declare our bankruptcy in the spiritual domain? Is it impossible to multiply the exceptions so as to make them the rule? Must man always be brute first, and man after, if at all? Americans may well remember with pride the successful non-violence experiment of William Penn in founding his 17th century colony in Pennsylvania. There were no forts, no soldiers, no militia, even no arms. Amidst the savage frontier wars and the butcheries that went on between the new settlers and the Red Indians, the Quakers of Pennsylvania alone remained unmolested. Others were slain, others were massacred, but they were safe. Not a Quaker woman suffered assault, not a Quaker child was slain, not a Quaker man was tortured. When the Quakers were finally forced to give up the government of the state, war broke out and some Pennsylvanians were killed. But only three Quakers were killed. Three, who had so far fallen from their faith as to carry weapons of defense. Resort to force in the Great War failed to bring tranquility, Franklin D. Roosevelt pointed out. Victory and defeat were alike sterile. That lesson the world should have learned. The more weapons of violence, the more misery to mankind, Lao Tzu taught. The triumph of violence ends in a festival of mourning. I am fighting for nothing less than world peace, Gandhi has declared. If the Indian movement is carried to success on a non-violent satyagraha basis, it will give a new meaning to patriotism and, if I may say so, in all humility, to life itself. Before the West dismisses Gandhi's program as one of an impractical dreamer, let it first reflect on a definition of satyagraha by the Master of Galilee. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil with evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Gandhi's epoch has extended, with the beautiful precision of cosmic timing, into a century already desolated and devastated by two world wars. A divine handwriting appears on the granite wall of his life, a warning against the further shedding of blood among brothers. He was, in the true sense, the father of the nation, and a madman has slain him. Millions and millions are mourning because the light has gone out. The light that shone in this land was no ordinary light. For 1,000 years, that light will be seen in this country, and the world will see it. So spoke Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, shortly after Mahatma Gandhi had been assassinated in New Delhi on January the 30th, 1948. 5 months earlier, India had peacefully achieved her national independence. The work of the 78-year-old Gandhi was done. He realized that his hour was nigh. "Abba, bring me all the important papers," he said to his grandniece on the morning of the tragedy. "I must reply today. Tomorrow may never be." In numerous passages of his writings also, Gandhi gave intimations of his final destiny. As the dying Mahatma sank slowly to the ground, 3 bullets in his frail and fast-worn body, he lifted his hands in the traditional Hindu gesture of greeting, silently bestowing his forgiveness. Innocent artist as he was in all the ways of his life, Gandhi became a supreme artist at the moment of his death. All the sacrifices of his selfless life had made possible that final loving gesture. Generations to come, it may be, Albert Einstein wrote in a tribute to the Mahatma, will scarcely believe that such a one as this, ever in flesh and blood, walked upon the earth. A dispatch from the Vatican in Rome said, "The assassination caused great sorrow here. Gandhi is mourned as an apostle of Christian virtues." Fraught with symbolic meaning are the lives of all great ones who come to earth for the accomplishment of a specific righteousness. Gandhi's dramatic death in the cause of Indian unity has highlighted his message to a world torn in every continent with disunity. That message he has stated in prophetic words, "Non-violence has come among men, and it will live. It is the harbinger of the peace of the world." Chapter 45. The Bengali Joy-Permeated Mother. "Sir, please do not leave India without a glimpse of Nirmala Devi. Her sanctity is intense. She is known far and wide as Ananda Moyi Ma. joy-permeated mother. My niece, Amio Bos, gazed at me earnestly. "Of course, I want very much to see the woman saint," I added. "I have read of her advanced state of God-realization. A little article about her appeared years ago in East West." "I have met her," Amio went on. "She recently visited my own small town of Jamshedpur. At the entreaty of a disciple, Ananda Moy Ma went to the home of a dying man. She stood by his bedside. As her hand touched his forehead, his death rattle ceased. The disease vanished at once, to the man's glad astonishment. He was well. A few days later, I heard that the blissful mother was staying at the home of a disciple in the Bhawanipur section of Calcutta. Mr. Wright and I set out immediately for my father's Calcutta home. As the Ford neared the Bhawanipur house, my companion and I observed an unusual street scene. Ananda Moy Ma was standing in an open-topped automobile, blessing a throng of about 100 disciples. She was evidently on the point of departure. Mr. Wright parked the Ford some distance away and accompanied me on foot towards the quiet assemblage. The woman saint glanced in our direction. She alit from her car and walked towards us. "Father, you have come." With these fervent words in Bengali, she put her arm around my neck and her head on my shoulder. Mr. Wright, to whom I had just remarked that I did not know the saint, was hugely enjoying this extraordinary demonstration of welcome. The eyes of the 100 chelas were also fixed with some surprise on the affectionate tableau. I had instantly seen that the saint was in a high state of samadhi. Oblivious to her outward garb as a woman, she knew herself as the changeless soul. From that plane, she was joyously greeting another devotee of God. She led me by the hand into her automobile. "Ananda Moy Ma, I am delaying your journey," I protested. "Father, I am meeting you for the first time in this life after ages," she said. "Please do not leave yet." We sat together in the rear seats of the car. The blissful mother soon entered the immobile ecstatic state. Her beautiful eyes glanced heavenward and, half opened, became stilled, gazing into the near-far inner Elysium. The disciples chanted gently, "Victory to Mother Divine." I had found many men of God-realization in India, but never before had I met such an exalted woman saint. Her gentle face was burnished with the ineffable joy that had given her the name of Blissful Mother. Long black tresses lay loosely behind her unveiled head. A red dot of sandalwood paste on her forehead symbolized the spiritual eye, ever open within her. Tiny face, tiny hands, tiny feet, a contrast to her spiritual magnitude. I put some questions to a nearby woman chela while Ananda Moy Ma remained entranced. The blissful mother travels widely in India. In many parts she has hundreds of disciples, the chela told me. Her courageous efforts have brought about many desirable social reforms. Although a Brahmin, the saint recognizes no caste distinctions. A group of us always travels with her, looking after her comforts. We have to mother her. She takes no notice of her body. If no one gave her food, she would not eat or make any inquiries. Even when meals are placed before her, she does not touch them. To prevent her disappearance from this world, we disciples feed her with our own hands. For days together she often stays in the divine trance, scarcely breathing, her eyes unwinking. One of her chief disciples is her husband, Bholanath. Many years ago, soon after their marriage, he took the vow of silence. The chela pointed to a broad-shouldered, fine-featured man with long hair and a hoary beard. He was standing quietly in the midst of the gathering, his hands folded in a disciple's reverential attitude. Refreshed by her dip in the infinite, Ananda Moy Ma was now focusing her consciousness on the material world. "Father, please tell me where you stay." Her voice was clear and melodious. "At present, in Calcutta or Ranchi, but soon I shall be returning to America." "America?" "Yes. An Indian woman saint would be sincerely appreciated there by spiritual seekers. Would you like to go?" "If Father can take me, I will go." This reply caused her nearby disciples to start in alarm. 20 or more of us always travel with the blissful mother, one of them told me firmly. We could not live without her. Wherever she goes, we must go. Reluctantly, I abandoned the plan, as possessing an impractical feature of spontaneous enlargement. "Please, come at least to Ranchi with your devotees," I said on taking leave of the saint. "As a divine child yourself, you will enjoy the little ones in my school. Whenever Father takes me, I will gladly go." A short time later, the Ranchi Vidyalaya was in gala array for the saint's promised visit. The youngsters looked forward to any day of festivity, no lessons, hours of music, and a feast for the climax. "Victory! Ananda Moima Kijai!" This reiterated chant from scores of enthusiastic little throats greeted the saint's party as it entered the school gates. Showers of marigolds, tinkle of cymbals, lusty blowing of conch shells, and beat of the mridanga drum. The blissful mother wandered smilingly over the sunny Vidyalaya grounds, ever carrying within her heart the portable paradise. "It is beautiful here," Ananda Moima said graciously as I led her into the main building. She seated herself with a childlike smile by my side. The closest of dear friends, she made one feel, yet an aura of remoteness was ever around her, the paradoxical isolation of omnipresence. "Please tell me something of your life." "Father knows all about it. Why repeat it?" She evidently felt that the factual history of one short incarnation was beneath notice. I laughed, gently repeating my request. "Father, there is little to tell." She spread her graceful hands in a deprecatory gesture. "My consciousness has never associated itself with this temporary body. Before I came on this earth, Father, I was the same. As a little girl, I was the same. I grew into womanhood, still, I was the same. When the family in which I had been born made arrangements to have this body married, I was the same. And Father, in front of you now, I am the same. Ever afterward, though the dance of creation change around me in the hall of eternity, I shall be the same." Ananda Moima sank into a deep meditative state. Her form was statue still. She had fled to her ever-calling kingdom. The dark pools of her eyes appeared lifeless and glassy. This expression is often present when saints remove their consciousness from the physical body, which is then hardly more than a piece of soulless clay. We sat together for an hour in the ecstatic trance. She returned to this world with a gay little laugh. "Please, Ananda Moima," I said, "come with me to the garden. Mr. Wright will take some pictures." "Of course, Father. Your will is my will." Her glorious eyes retained an unchanging divine luster as she posed for many photographs. Time for the feast. Ananda Moima squatted on her blanket seat, a disciple at her elbow to feed her. Like an infant, the saint obediently swallowed the food after the chela had brought it to her lips. It was plain that the blissful mother did not recognize any difference between curries and sweetmeats. As dusk approached, the saint left with her party amidst a shower of rose petals, her hands raised in blessing on the little lads. Their faces shone with the affection she had effortlessly awakened. "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength," Christ has proclaimed. "This is the first commandment." Casting aside every inferior attachment, Ananda Moima offers her soul allegiance to the Lord. not by hair-splitting distinctions of scholars, but by the sure logic of faith. The childlike saint has solved the only problem in human life, establishment of unity with God. Man has forgotten this stark simplicity, now befogged by a million issues. Refusing a monotheistic love to the Creator, nations try to disguise their infidelity by punctilious respect before the outward shrines of charity. These humanitarian gestures are virtuous because for a moment they divert man's attention from himself. But they do not free him from his prime responsibility in life, referred to by Jesus as the first commandment. The uplifting obligation to love God is assumed with man's earliest breath of air, freely bestowed by his only benefactor. On one other occasion, after her visit to the Ranchi school, I had opportunity to see Ananda Moy Ma. She stood with a group some months later on the Serampore station platform, waiting for the train. "Father, I am going to the Himalayas," she told me. "Some kind persons have built for us a hermitage in Dehradun." As she boarded the train, I marveled to see that, whether amidst a crowd, on a train, feasting, or sitting in silence, her eyes never looked away from God. Within me, I still hear her voice, an echo of measureless sweetness. "Behold, now and always, one with the Eternal, I am ever the same." Chapter 46. The Woman Yogi Who Never Eats. "Sir, whither are we bound this morning?" Mr. Wright was driving the Ford. He took his eyes off the road long enough to gaze at me with a questioning twinkle. From day to day, he seldom knew what part of Bengal he would be discovering next. "God willing," I replied devoutly, "we are on our way to see an eighth wonder of the world, a woman saint whose diet is thin air." Repetition of wonders after Theresa Neumann, but Mr. Wright laughed eagerly just the same. He even accelerated the speed of the car. More extraordinary grist for his travel diary. Not one of an average tourist, that. The Ranchi school had just been left behind us. We had risen before the sun. Besides my secretary and me, three Bengali friends were in the party. We drank in the exhilarating air, the natural wine of the morning. Our driver guided the car warily among the early peasants and the two-wheeled carts, slowly drawn by yoked, hump-shouldered bullocks, inclined to dispute the road with a honking interloper. "Sir, we would like to know more of the fasting saint." "Her name is Giri Bala," I informed my companions. "I first heard about her years ago from a scholarly gentleman, Stiti Lal Nundi. He often came to the Garpar Road home to tutor my brother Bishnu." "I know Giri Bala well," Stiti Babu told me. "She employs a certain yoga technique that enables her to live without eating. I was her close neighbor in Nawabganj, near Ichapur, in northern Bengal. I made it a point to watch her closely. Never did I find evidence that she was either taking food or drink." My interest finally mounted so high that I approached the Maharaja of Burdwan and asked him to conduct an investigation. Astounded at the story, he invited her to his palace. She agreed to a test and lived for 2 months, locked up in a small section of his home. Later she returned for a palace visit of 20 days, and then for a third test of 15 days. The Maharaja himself told me that these three rigorous scrutinies had convinced him beyond doubt of her non-eating state. This story of Sita Babu's has remained in my mind for over 25 years, I concluded. Sometimes, in America, I wondered if the river of time would not swallow the yogini before I could meet her. She must be quite aged now. I do not even know where or if she lives. But in a few hours we shall reach Purulia. Her brother has a home there. By 10:30, our little group was conversing with the brother, Lambardar Day, a lawyer of Purulia. "Yes, my sister is living. She sometimes stays with me here, but at present She's at our family home in Biur. Lambadar Babu glanced doubtfully at the ford. I hardly think, Swamiji, that any automobile has ever penetrated into the interior as far as Biur. It might be best if you all resign yourselves to the jolts of a bullock cart. As one voice, our party pledged loyalty to the pride of Detroit. The ford comes from America, I told the lawyer. It will be a shame to deprive it of an opportunity to get acquainted with the heart of Bengal. May Ganesh go with you, Lambadar Babu said, laughing. He added courteously, if you ever get there, I'm sure Giri Bala will be glad to see you. She's approaching her 70s, but continues in excellent health. Please tell me, sir, if it is absolutely true that she eats nothing. I looked directly into his eyes, those telltale windows of the mind. It is true. His gaze was open and honourable. In more than 5 decades, I have never seen her eat a morsel. If the world suddenly came to an end, I could not be more astonished than by the sight of my sisters taking food. We chuckled together over the improbability of these two cosmic events. Giri Bala has never sought an inaccessible solitude for her yoga practices, Lambadar Babu went on. She has lived her entire life surrounded by her family and friends. They are all well accustomed now to her strange state. Not one of them who would not be stupefied if Giri Bala suddenly decided to eat anything. Sister is naturally retiring, as befits a Hindu widow, but our little circle in Purulia and in Biur all know that she is literally an exceptional woman. The brother's sincerity was manifest. Our little party thanked him warmly and set out towards Biur. We stopped at a street shop for curry and luchis, attracting a swarm of urchins who gathered around to watch Mr. Wright eating with his fingers in the simple Hindu manner. Hearty appetites caused us to fortify ourselves against an afternoon which, unknown to us at the moment, was to prove fairly laborious. Our way now led east, through the sun-baked rice fields, into the Burdwan section of Bengal, on through roads lined with dense vegetation. The songs of the miners and the striped-throated bulbuls streamed out from trees with huge umbrella-like branches. A bullock cart now and then, the reeny, reeny, manju, manju squeak of its axle and iron-shod wooden wheels contrasting sharply in mind with the swish, swish of auto-tires over the aristocratic asphalt of the cities. Dick, halt. My sudden request brought a jolting protest from the ford. That overburdened mango tree is fairly shouting an invitation. The five of us dashed like children to the mango-strewn earth. The tree had benevolently shed its fruit as they had ripened. Full many a mango is born to lie unseen, I paraphrased, and waste its sweetness on the stony ground. Nothing like this in America, Swamiji, eh? Laughed Sailesh Mazumdar, one of my Bengali students. No, I admitted, filled with mangoes and contentment. How I have missed this fruit in the West. A Hindu's heaven without mangoes is inconceivable. I hurled a rock and downed a proud beauty from the highest limb. Dick, I asked, between bites of ambrosia, warm in the tropical sun. Are all the cameras in the car? Yes, sir, in the baggage compartment. If Giri Bala proves to be a true saint, I want to write about her in the West. A Hindu yogini with such inspiring powers should not live and die unknown, like most of these mangoes. Half an hour later, I was still strolling in the sylvan peace. Sir, Mr. Wright remarked, we should reach Giri Bala before the sun sets, to have enough light for photographs, he added with a grin. Westerners are a sceptical lot. We can't expect them to believe in the lady without any pictures. This bit of wisdom was indisputable. I turned my back on temptation and re-entered the car. You're right, Dick, I sighed as we sped along. I sacrificed the mango paradise on the altar of Western realism. Photographs we must have. The road became more and more sickly. Wrinkles of ruts, boils of hardened clay, the sad infirmities of old age. Our group dismounted occasionally to allow Mr. Wright more easily to manoeuvre the ford, which the rest of us pushed from behind. Lambador Babu spoke truly, Salesh acknowledged. The car is not carrying us. We are carrying the car. Our climb-in, climb-out auto tedium was beguiled ever and anon by the appearance of a village, each one a scene of quaint simplicity. Our way twisted and turned through groves of palms among ancient, unspoiled villages nestling in the forest shade. Mr. Wright recorded in his travel diary, under the date of May 5, 1936, "Very fascinating are these clusters of thatched mud huts, decorated with one of the names of God on the door. Many small, naked children, innocently playing about, pausing to stare or run wildly from this big, black, bullockless carriage, tearing madly through their village. The women merely peep from the shadows, while the men lazily loll beneath the trees along the roadside, curious beneath their nonchalance. In one place, all the villagers were gaily bathing in the large tank, in their garments, changing by draping dry cloths around their bodies, dropping the wet ones. Women bearing water to their homes in huge brass jars. The road led us a merry chase over mount and ridge. We bounced and tossed, dipped into small streams, detoured around an unfinished causeway, slithered across dry, sandy riverbeds, and finally, at about 5 p.m, we were close to our destination, Biur. This small village in the interior of Bankura district, hidden in the protection of dense foliage, is unapproachable by travellers in the rainy season, we were told. Then the streams are raging torrents, and the roads, serpent-like, spit mud venom. Asking for a guide among a group of worshippers on their way home from a temple prayer, out in the lonely field, we were besieged by a dozen scantily clad lads who clambered on the sides of the car, eager to conduct us to Giribala. The road led toward a grove of date palms, sheltering a group of mud huts, but before we had reached it, the ford was momentarily tipped at a dangerous angle, tossed up and dropped down. The narrow trail led around trees and tanks, over ridges, into holes and deep ruts. The car became anchored on a clump of bushes, then grounded on a hillock, requiring a lift of earth clods. On we proceeded, slowly and carefully. Suddenly, the way was stopped by a mass of brush in the middle of the cart track, necessitating a detour down a precipitous ledge into a dry tank, rescue from which demanded some scraping, adzing, and shoveling. Again and again the road seemed impassable, but the pilgrimage must go on. Obliging lads fetched spades and demolished the obstacles, blessings of Ganesh, while hundreds of children and parents stared. Soon we were threading our way along the two ruts of antiquity, women gazing wide-eyed from their hut doors, men trailing alongside and behind us, children scampering to swell the procession. Ours was perhaps the first auto to traverse these roads. The bullock cart union must be omnipotent here. What a sensation we created! A group piloted by an American and pioneering in a snorting car right into their hamlet fastness, invading the ancient privacy and sanctity. Halting by a narrow lane, we found ourselves within 100 feet of Giribala's ancestral home. We felt the thrill of fulfilment after the long road struggle crowned by a rough finish. We approached a large, two-storied building of brick and plaster, dominating the surrounding adobe huts. The house was under the process of repair, for around it there was the characteristically tropical framework of bamboo. With feverish anticipation and suppressed rejoicing, we stood before the open doors of the one blessed by the Lord's hungerless touch. Constantly agape were the villagers, young and old, bare and dressed, women aloof somewhat but inquisitive too, men and boys unabashedly at our heels as they gazed on this unprecedented spectacle. Soon, a short figure came into view in the doorway. Giribala. She was swathed in a cloth of dull, goldish silk, in typically Indian fashion. She drew forward modestly and hesitatingly, peering at us from beneath the upper fold of her Swadeshi cloth. Her eyes glistened like smouldering embers from the shadows of her headpiece. We were enamoured by a face of benevolence and self-realisation, free from the taint of earthly attachment. Meekly she approached, and silently assented to our snapping a number of pictures with our still and movie cameras. Patiently and shyly, she endured our photo techniques of posture adjustment and light arrangement. Finally, we had recorded for posterity many photographs of the only woman in the world who is known to have lived without food or drink for over 50 years. Therese Neumann, of course, has fasted since 1923. Most motherly was Giri Bala's expression as she stood before us, completely covered in the loose-flowing cloth, nothing of her body visible but her face with its downcast eyes, her hands and her tiny feet. A face of rare peace and innocent poise, a wide, childlike, quivering lip, a feminine nose, narrow, sparkling eyes, and a wistful smile. Mr. Wright's impression of Giri Bala was shared by me. Spirituality unfolded her, like her gently shining veil. She pranamed before me in the customary gesture of greeting from a householder to a monk. Her simple charm and quiet smile gave us a welcome beyond that of honeyed oratory. Forgotten was our difficult, dusty trip. The little saint seated herself cross-legged on the veranda. Though bearing the scars of age, she was not emaciated. Her olive-coloured skin had remained clear and healthy in tone. "Mother," I said in Bengali, "for over 25 years I have thought eagerly of this very pilgrimage. I heard about your sacred life from Stiti Lal Nandi Babu." She nodded in acknowledgement. "Yes, my good neighbour in Nawab Ganj. During those years I have crossed the oceans, but never forgot my plan some day to see you. The sublime drama that you are here playing so inconspicuously should be blazoned before a world that has long forgotten the inner food divine." The saint lifted her eyes for a minute, smiling with serene interest. "Baba, honoured father, knows best," she answered meekly. I was happy that she had taken no offence. One never knows how yogis and yoginis will react to the thought of publicity. They shun it as a rule, wishing to pursue in silence the profound soul research. An inner sanction comes to them when the proper time arrives to display their lives openly for the benefit of seeking minds. "Mother," I went on, "forgive me then for burdening you with many questions. Kindly answer only those that please you. I shall understand your silence also." She spread her hands in a gracious gesture. "I am glad to reply, in so far as an insignificant person like myself can give satisfactory answers." "Oh, no, not insignificant," I protested sincerely. "You are a great soul. I am the humble servant of all." She added quaintly, "I love to cook and to feed people." A strange pastime, I thought, for a non-eating saint. "Tell me, mother, from your own lips, do you live without food?" "That is true." She was silent for a few moments. Her next remark showed that she had been struggling with mental arithmetic. "From the age of 12 years, 4 months, down to my present age of 68, a period of over 56 years, I have not eaten food or taken liquids. Are you never tempted to eat?" "If I felt a craving for food, I would have to eat." Simply, yet regally, she stated this axiomatic truth, one known too well by a world revolving round 3 meals a day. "But you do eat something." My tone held a note of remonstrance. "Of course," she smiled in swift understanding, "your nourishment is derived from the finer energies of the air and sunlight, and from the cosmic power that recharges your body through the medulla oblongata. Baba knows." Again she acquiesced, her manner soothing and unemphatic. Mother, please tell me about your early life. It holds a deep interest for all of India, and even for our brothers and sisters beyond the seas. Giribala put aside her habitual reserve, relaxing into a conversational mood. So be it. Her voice was low and firm. I was born in these forest regions. My childhood was unremarkable, save that I was possessed by an insatiable appetite. I had been betrothed when I was about 9 years old. Child, my mother often warned me, try to control your greed. When the time comes for you to live among strangers in your husband's family, what will they think of you if your days are spent in nothing but eating? The calamity she had foreseen came to pass. I was only 12 when I joined my husband's people in Nawab Ganj. My mother-in-law shamed me morning, noon, and night about my gluttonous habits. Her scoldings were a blessing in disguise, however. They roused my dormant spiritual tendencies. One morning, her ridicule was merciless. "I shall soon prove to you," I said, stung to the quick, "that I shall never touch food again as long as I live." My mother-in-law laughed in derision. "So," she said, "how can you live without eating, when you cannot live without overeating?" This remark was unanswerable, yet an iron resolution had entered my heart. In a secluded spot, I sought my heavenly Father. "Lord," I prayed incessantly, "please send me a guru, one who can teach me to live by thy light and not by food." An ecstasy fell over me. In a beatific spell, I set out for the Nawab Ganj Ghat on the Ganges. On the way, I encountered the priest of my husband's family. "Venerable sir," I said trustingly, "kindly tell me how to live without eating." He stared at me without reply. Finally he spoke in a consoling manner. "Child," he said, "come to the temple this evening. I will conduct a special Vedic ceremony for you." This vague answer was not the one I was seeking. I continued toward the Ghat. The morning sun pierced the waters. I purified myself in the Ganges, as though for a sacred initiation. As I left the river bank, my wet cloth around me, in the broad glare of day, my master materialized himself before me. "Dear little one," he said in a voice of loving compassion, "I am the guru sent here by God to fulfill your urgent prayer." He was deeply touched by its very unusual nature. "From today you shall live by the astral light. Your bodily atoms shall be recharged by the infinite current." Giribala fell into silence. I took Mr. Wright's pencil and pad and translated into English a few items for his information. The saint resumed the tale, her gentle voice barely audible. "The Ghat was deserted, but my guru cast around us an aura of guarding light, that no stray bathers later disturb us. He initiated me into a kriya technique that frees the body from dependence on the gross food of mortals. The technique includes the use of a certain mantra and a breathing exercise more difficult than the average person could perform. No medicine or magic is involved, nothing beyond the kriya." In the manner of the American newspaper reporter who had unknowingly taught me his procedure, I questioned Giribala on many matters that I thought would be of interest to the world. She gave me, bit by bit, the following information. "I have never had any children. Many years ago, I became a widow. I sleep very little, as sleep and waking are the same to me. I meditate at night, attending to my domestic duties in the daytime. I slightly feel the change in climate from season to season. I have never been sick or experienced any disease. I feel only slight pain when accidentally injured. I have no bodily excretions. I can control my heartbeat and breathing. In visions, I often see my guru and other great souls." "Mother," I asked, "why don't you teach others the method of living without food?" My ambitious hopes for the world's starving millions were quickly shattered. "No." She shook her head. "I was strictly commanded by my guru not to divulge the secret." It is not his wish to tamper with God's drama of creation. The farmers would not thank me if I taught many people to live without eating. The luscious fruits would lie useless on the ground. It appears that misery, starvation, and disease are whips of our karma that ultimately drive us to seek the true meaning of life. Mother, I said slowly, what is the use of your having been singled out to live without eating? To prove that man is spirit. Her face lit with wisdom. To demonstrate that by divine advancement, he can gradually learn to live by the eternal light and not by food. The saint sank into a deep meditative state. Her gaze was directed inward. The gentle depths of her eyes became expressionless. She gave a certain sigh, the prelude to the ecstatic breathless trance. For a time, she had fled to the questionless realm, the heaven of inner joy. The tropical darkness had fallen. The light of a small kerosene lamp flickered fitfully over the heads of many villagers squatting silently in the shadows. The darting glowworms and distant oil lanterns of the huts wove bright, eerie patterns into the velvet night. It was the painful hour of parting. A slow, tedious journey lay before our little party. "Giri Bala," I said as the saint opened her eyes, "please give me a keepsake, a strip from one of your saris." She soon returned with a piece of Banaras silk, extending it in her hands as she suddenly prostrated herself on the ground. "Mother," I said reverently, "rather let me touch your own blessed feet." Chapter 47. I Return to the West. I have given many yoga lessons in India and America, but I must confess that, as a Hindu, I am unusually happy to be conducting a class for English students. My London class members laughed appreciatively. No political turmoils ever disturbed our yoga peace. India was now a hallowed memory. It is September 1936. I am in England to fulfill a promise, given 16 months earlier, to lecture again in London. England, too, is receptive to the timeless yoga message. Reporters and newsreel cameramen swarmed over my quarters at Grosvenor House. The British National Council of the World Fellowship of Faiths organized a meeting on September the 29th at Whitefield Congregational Church, where I addressed the audience on the weighty subject of how faith in fellowship may save civilization. The 8 o'clock lectures at Caxton Hall attracted such crowds that on two nights the overflow waited in Windsor House Auditorium for my second talk at 9:30. Yoga classes during the following weeks grew so large that Mr. Wright was obliged to arrange a transfer to another hall. English tenacity has an admirable expression in a spiritual relationship. The London yoga students loyally organized themselves after my departure into a self-realization fellowship center, holding their meditation meetings weekly throughout the bitter war years. Unforgettable weeks in England, days of sightseeing in London, then over the beautiful countryside. Mr. Wright and I used the trusty Ford to visit the birthplaces and tombs of the great poets and heroes of British history. Our little party sailed from Southampton for America in late October on the Bremen. The sight of the majestic Statue of Liberty in New York Harbour brought to our throats joyous emotional gulps. The Ford, a bit battered from struggles over ancient soils, was still puissant. It now took in its stride the transcontinental trip to California. In late 1936, lo, Mount Washington Center. The year-end holidays are celebrated annually at the Los Angeles Center with an 8-hour group meditation on December 24th, Spiritual Christmas, followed the next day by a banquet, Social Christmas. The festivities this year were augmented by the presence of dear friends and students from distant cities who had arrived to welcome home the 3 world travelers. The Christmas Day feast included delicacies brought 15,000 miles for this glad occasion. Gucci mushrooms from Kashmir, canned rasagulla and mango pulp, papar biscuits, and an oil of the Indian kiora flower.